Welcome to the Canon Cantina, a Star Wars show where we try to answer the question, who is Luke Skywalker? How you doing, everybody? My name is Mike. I am here on Salt Lake Base on planet Utah, and I am joined by my Star Wars best friend, Jesse, who is on location today from planet Vortex. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go listen to, I think, the second episode of our Jedi Academy trilogy, because it's a planet full of wind, and that's where Jesse is right now.
That's right, Mike. I can literally hear the sirens going off right now, which always make me think of Silent Hill, which is very exciting for me in a weird sadistic way. But yeah, we've got the tornado sirens. We've got the flash flood warnings going off on my phone. We got the thunder. I mean, it's proper tornado alley right now.
The sounds you miss from the place you grew up in.
That's right. this is a little atypical for us because Tulsa, of course, has tornado warnings, that usually not this extreme. We're usually protected by hills and trees, unlike the rest of the state. But this storm, basically, Mike, is going northeast from Dallas all the way up across, slashing across Oklahoma like that at an angle. So everybody's basically being hit right now. And this is just the way things are. Phantom Menace is this important to me that we got a podcast during a tornado. Come on, let's do it.
That's true. It is important to note we are on attempt number two because the storm did knock Jesse out of commission the first time.
That's right. Bill Paxton did not save me the first time. I hope Bill Paxton will save me this time. Oh, man. I am living out Twister. So rip Bill Paxton and rip Philip Seymour Hoffman, both in that film.
Oh, yeah.
Man, good stuff.
So that's a little sad. Let's go to something happy, like the 20th anniversary of The Phantom Menace. Ooh. It happened just a few days ago.
That's right.
Jesse went to a panel about that at Star Wars Celebration.
I did. I recorded
the actual anniversary passed just a few days ago. So we thought we'd spend some time talking about it. And we've got some different takes and opinions on it. I don't think I'm going to make anyone too angry. But you know, I never know when we get into to these shenanigans. So, we were just talking before we started recording. I was 12 years old when Phantom Menace came out in theaters and Jesse was like 11 and a half.
That's right.
So we were like the target audience, right?
Right. We were the target audience. I think, maybe a couple years younger than us was the true target audience. But the fact that we had an entire history of Star Wars obsession, including reading all of Legends up to this point, Mike, I think we were in the upper percentage of target audience. We were the right age. We were fully invested in the universe. We had grown up with the film since we were a child, all that. And we had read all the Legends material up to this point, which if you guys have been following the show, 1990-ish all the way to 2000, basically where the Phantom Menace cycle was over. It's a lot of books. It was a lot.
Yeah, so we were definitely like the Star Wars, like we were the Star Wars kid in some respects.
That's good.
So the past few days, all over social media, I've just seen this like great appreciation and love fest for The Phantom Menace and people sharing their first memories of it. Do you remember the first time you saw Phantom Menace in theaters?
I do, Mike. I think it was the second night it was in theaters, as in probably the Friday, not the midnight release or the early showings on Friday. It was the Friday evening. And I went with my family, and I think I've told this story on the show a few times. If anyone's missed it, it was pretty funny. Our neighbors saw it somehow before us. Once again, I wasn't 16, so I couldn't drive. So I had to wait, which I would not do today, as you know. Wait the entire day. And I went with my family, and me and my dad were especially really excited. Like I told you, we recorded the trailer. This is something I actually mentioned on our celebration recap day five. That was just me. I mentioned how impactful that trailer was. It's probably one of the biggest trailers in the entire world to ever happen. Probably to this date too. And me and my dad recorded the trailer on a VHS and watched that on repeat a lot. Because they debuted the trailer on like 60 Minutes or something like that. And really hyped for it. And we were going to theater to see it. And my neighbor was like, we saw it. We really liked it. Like, we especially liked, you know, X and Y and all this stuff. And we're like, okay, great. We're going right now. And our neighbor was like, now someone dies. Just letting you know. And we're like,
the worst.
What? And they're like, yeah, but one of the good guys dies, but
That's all I'm going to tell you. And it's like, we just sat there and did the math. We're like, it's not Yoda. It's not Obi-Wan. It's not Padme. You know, it's so easy. And we're like, yeah. Okay, Qui-Gon, great. And we went to the movie.
Run over them with your car. Yeah.
It was not great. I don't think my parents still talk to that neighbor, so that was fate. But that's the way of things. And kind of knew Qui-Gon was going to die. And also, Mike, the fun story I have on top of this, I don't think this is something you even know. The day after I saw The Phantom Menace, a day or two later, you know, that was the weekend. Then it was Monday. One of my dad's engineering friends gave my dad a bootleg copy of The Phantom Menace on CD-ROM. So then I just watched it at home on repeat.
No, I think I do remember.
And you might have gotten it too, because our dads worked together.
No, I don't think I got it, but I think just hanging out with you, you're like, hey, guess what? I got this thing. It's like, oh, you got a bag of weed over there or something? Nope, no. We got the Phantom Menace bootleg.
Right, and you got to keep in mind how it sounds funny to probably younger listeners, especially now, but like, that was a really big deal to us. The internet was in its infancy, and there was no such thing as video streaming or anything online. So it was like, if you had a bootleg of something, right. it was a big deal.
If you had a bootleg of something, you were a Napster pioneer.
Yeah, way before the time of Napster and all that, which is crazy to think. So I had a CD-ROM. It was like a compressed like DRV format or something of The Phantom Menace. So I could just watch it over and over again at home as well. But then, of course, you know, we mentioned on the show, that also was the time in the late 90s of the birthday party, movie party sort of thing that swept all middle school aged kids. And I went to about 6 birthday parties that were The Phantom Menace, and I saw it like 3 times by myself, you know, with family and other things like that. So I saw the movie like 10 times in theaters, at least.
What about the rest of the prequels? Do you remember seeing episode 2 and episode 3 in theaters?
That's a good question. I definitely do, because I was older. I was old enough to see Phantom Attack of the Clones. I still don't think I could drive yet, but I was getting close. And then, of course, Revenge of the Sith, I remember more vividly. I did drive myself there. I went with a group of friends. We went opening night. There was actually people dressed up. There was lightsabers in the audience. Yeah, that was really fun. I just think I remember that. Attack of the Clones, I don't really remember as much. I remember more the DVD on repeat of that one.
Well, and this is what I've found so interesting to me the past few days, seeing everybody posting all their memories. I know that I saw all of the prequels in theaters.
Of course.
Either opening day or close to it, like you, if I was young enough. And I'm sure I saw them multiple times. I don't remember a single like detail about seeing them in theaters.
Because weren't you like 17 when Revenge of the Sith came out?
And I think I was a senior in high school.
Yeah.
And like
17 or 18.
Like I know like factually that like I remember driving to the theater to see it like a second or third time or something.
Okay. Yeah.
But I don't have any of these like, this really burned in my memory, this important pivotal Star Wars moment or film moment for me. Like, I know I saw them lots of times, and like I can picture like seeing them in all the different movie theaters in Tulsa, but I was surprised to be like, you know, was it just not that important to me, or has the youngling rotted my brain to the point where I've just kind of lost all those details?
That seems more likely. Like, you know.
Well, and I'm not saying that these movies weren't important to me, because obviously I was that target demographic. I loved him when we were kids. You and I were both doing martial arts.
That's
at
right.
One of those pyramid scheme martial arts places, if you remember the conversation we had with our Uber driver at Celebration.
Yeah, I'm so glad I brought that up to him. I didn't expect him to go that deep with us.
That was crazy.
Yeah, that was crazy.
But like the whole like, oh, Darth Maul with a staff and 2 Jedis with swords kind of thing.
Right.
And like, we played out all that stuff. It was episode 1 created such great like imagination fuel.
Oh yeah.
The world building that happened there.
Oh, the concept
there,
art, Doug Chang, just brilliant. We've talked about
and
this.
I actually particularly remember the games, maybe more so than going to see the movie.
Yeah.
We got Starfighter, the pod racing
Racer,
game.
Yeah.
episode
one. Jedi Power Battles, which was an underrated PlayStation 1, maybe not classic, but for a,
very
a Star Wars
game.
Kid looking for a new Star Wars game, very difficult, very different game too.
Yeah, very different, and it didn't follow the story of the movies, which I thought was very exciting. And on top of that, Mike, Jedi Power Battles was our first major exposure to the Jedi Masters outside of Qui-Gon, Yoda, and of course Obi-Wan as a Jedi Knight. So you played these other Jedi Masters in the game, and that was our main exposure to them, other than that one scene in the Jedi Council where they test Anakin, yeah. test Anakin and Qui-Gon. So that was a big deal for us too. Also, if you remember, I distinctly remember the episode one game, which was very exciting. It's the game where you mainly play as Obi-Wan the whole game. And it was kind of free roam, mm-hmm. free roam at times, which was kind of unheard
yep,
of.
Remember that
unheard
one.
Of for back in the day. I mean, like say the level on Otagunga, you could go all over Otagunga.
I feel like that made it extra difficult.
It did.
But I
it
yeah.
And then also there was a game that was one of the launch titles for the original Xbox. So, you know, a few years later after episode one release, but not very long, it was called Obi-Wan. And that was another game that was out during that time.
Was that an episode one era game? Yeah. I remember that. Yeah. I was just thinking it was later.
The story was pre-episode one, and then it went into parts of episode one. It went into a little bit after episode two, if I remember correctly. But bringing this all full circle, Mike, I don't think I ever had this discussion with you. Did you see the re-release of Phantom Menace in February of 2012 when it was in 3D? Because I saw that too in theaters.
I don't believe I did.
And you know something that happened? The Rotten Tomatoes score of Phantom Menace is mainly based off of that. And it actually went down when the film came back out again in 3D. And people re-reviewed it. The Metacritic Rotten Tomatoes score went down.
Was it people re-reviewing it, or just there were more people reviewing it for the first time?
Probably that.
Because Rotten Tomatoes wasn't a thing in 1999.
Right. But they still have. You're right, but Rotten Tomatoes has still retroactively gone back on all films and tried to compile all the reviews they can.
Yeah, but I mean, the re-release gets you a lot more like fresh takes on it.
Yeah, so the Metacritic Rotten Tomatoes score, of course, went down with the 3D, but I don't know if you saw that. It was pretty fun, and they had the 3D goggles that were either like Anakin's pod racer goggles, or they were like Darth Maul goggles, and it was pretty neat in 3D. I will say, like anything else in 3D, which there's not much with miniature work, but the miniatures looked the best in 3D out of everything, out of the film.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of sad that I know they were going to do the entire prequel trilogy in 3D and eventually the original trilogy, but when then George ended up selling Star Wars, and prior to him even selling Star Wars, they started talking, right, to sell Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And then I remember all of this going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember all this going on. I just don't think I actually went and saw it.
Well, if I remember correctly, episode 2 and 3 were only released in 3D at Star Wars Celebration, and we couldn't even get in because we saw the line at Anaheim to see those, and it was insane. Like, I would have loved to see Revenge of the Sith in 3D, but it was not even possible. People were waiting for hours.
Yeah, I don't think I did. I do want to spend just a little bit more time on this, like, I don't want to call it an age gap, but I think you and I were just on the old side. Like you said, maybe just ahead of the target audience age,
right.
Because there are so many great Star Wars fans and podcasts and YouTube channels that these past few days have been talking about how Phantom Menace started their love for Star Wars. They are the prequel generation.
Yeah. And we kind of are too. We're in a unique point, Mike, because I think our age is kind of an exceptional, strange age because we grew up with the original trilogy on VHS prior to the special edition. But when we were kind of at the age, like we were starting to get old enough to really be fully invested, was when the special edition came out. And then a couple of years passed, and then we got the prequels. And then, of course, everything
after
that. You know what I mean?
We're special edition kids, just a little older than the prequel generation.
Right. And we're older than that, really, because we distinctly remember pre-special edition, but we're not like, we didn't see it in theaters pre-special edition.
So right, our first but to me,
in theaters was special edition.
Yeah, to me, the special editions had more of an impact
100%.
Than seeing the prequels in theaters, right. Which I just thought was interesting because there's so many super popular, way better shows than ours that are like their fandom started with episode one and they like still love it and all the prequels to this day. Yeah. And it's, I just thought that was really interesting because there is like, there's a different flavor of Star Wars for everybody. And I'm not going to, you know, like degrade anybody for having a different favorite Star Wars movie than me or anything. It's just like, as you know, I rewatch these things and revisit things as an adult, I, you know, come to different conclusions than maybe kids or not kids, they're not kids now, they're adults, but people that were kids of the prequel generation.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and you know me, I've got a lot of thoughts on all of this. I unabashedly love all eras of Star Wars. But, you know, my personal favorite part about the prequel era, and Mike knows this very well, but people of the show might not know this, it might be my favorite world building of all the trilogies. And obviously that's a strength of the prequel trilogy, but like the particular style and feel, I really like the Doug Chang world building and feel. That's kind of my favorite part, but you know, we'll get into that when we get into more episode one specific stuff.
Well, I completely agree. The aesthetic and the options that were opened up.
It's the widest trilogy. It's the widest trilogy.
Are fantastic. Yeah. But my thing is when you consider them as films, I posted this on our Twitter the other day that like, did you actually read that article?
No.
The Phantom Menace has become almost like a cult camp classic just because before anyone gets mad, I love Star Wars and the Phantom Menace and the prequels, but it's like a failure of a movie for George Lucas.
Mm. What do you mean?
Looked at just as a movie in itself. It was the first quote bad movie that George Lucas had made. There were great storytelling elements throughout the movie, right. But in anybody's ranking of all the Star Wars movies, it's near the bottom. That's too much of a generalization. But it's not like on its own a great movie. There's failures in, comedic timing, right. Which I know that's the Last Jedi connection, but
yes, it is. You didn't mean to do that.
No, I did. I thought about that earlier today. I was figuring out what I was going to say on this thing. No,
Canto Bight feels very, very episode one to me. But that's a whole other thing.
Yeah. It was the first Star Wars movie that wasn't basically universally loved. And George had also made Indiana Jones movies up to this point.
That's true. So and American Graffiti and THX-1138, which, yeah, I know what you mean.
But nobody saw those. Of the movies that people saw.
I've seen all those, Mike, multiple times. These are good. You're right. Every movie he's made up till episode one was basically either critically received or widespread received, which is, that's saying something.
Because and it's not like episode one was a financial flop because that's not the case either. It still made lots of money, but it was the first time that maybe George Lucas stumbled. And it's not because he's a bad storyteller. No. Like we've mentioned, all those elements are there. I kind of just wish that George had worked with some other people on episode one. I think that would have made it a better movie.
Well, he was very focused on what George has always done, like the whole reason, like why things like Pixar exist because of George Lucas. It's like his emphasis on forwarding filmmaking and the technology is always a huge part of the films he's making. And with the prequels, that was an even bigger part, especially episode one.
Absolutely.
Especially episode one and two. Because episode one was all these compositing and editing techniques and things that had never been done, like taking many miniature sets with miniatures of ships, with real actors, with CG actors, all in one shot that had never been done in a film in the history of film. And then with episode two, he's doing one of the first films that's ever been done fully digital. Like he's pushing the medium and the story can suffer in ways because he's doing things financially with the medium that's never been done in the history of film. And
no,
and that's kind of a thing he's always been proud of, actually. He's actually proud of that.
And I agree. That stuff is great. He just needed to bring in some other people to write, right, because George has admitted to not being a great actor's director or screenwriter. Like, I think just those simple steps would have punched up the quality of the prequels a little bit. And it got better by the time we got to episode 3. I still think Phantom Menace is better than Attack of the Clones.
Yeah, that's kind of universal among most fans, though not all fans. But I believe that as well, Mike. I actually think Phantom Menace, to me, it's been kind of like a ski slope sort of thing. It was incredibly high when I was a young child, of course. And I think you should show it to all young children. And then it kind of dipped a bit in my maybe college years. And it's kind of re-jumped back up because it's just such a advance in filmmaking. It's absurd. I listened to the latest Blast Points and they were talking about Phantom Menace, and they were basically, they only were focusing on the miniature aspect of the film and how essentially every shot in the film has unbelievable X amount of miniatures in it. I mean, and we've talked about this, and I talked about this on day 5 recap of our show, but Doug Chang and all the guys at ILM have basically said numerous times and times again, not only is this the highest production miniature film in Star Wars, as in the most miniatures on screen, the most miniatures created, most miniatures, all that, but it might be the highest, like, most miniatures on screen of any film ever, because basically after episode 1 onward, CG became prominent because of episode 1 and other films like that, and miniatures went down exponentially. And, you know, we kind of see like episode 1 and like the Lord of the Rings and stuff, kind of the last major films that used a lot of miniatures. And then it kind of starts dipping off big time because the technology became accessible to everyone for CGI. But yeah, it's crazy that episode 1 might be the biggest miniature production film in the history of film. That is just crazy stuff. Like the Queen's ship is a miniature in every shot, which is just absurd because it's chrome, you know?
I'm thinking about this. Is that true compared to, say, Return of the Jedi, when all the spaceships were still miniatures?
According to the Star Wars guys that worked on it. But yeah, I think so, because every
source on that. And I'm not like saying that's obviously wrong, right, but I'm questioning, just because that's a lot of miniatures on screen, in Return of the Jedi.
You got to think about stuff in Phantom Menace. Like, there's things that even look CG at times that are not CG, which will truly blow your mind. It's like, most of the pod racers are CG unless they're exploding or something. And even a lot of the shots of them exploding and stuff are mainly miniatures. And usually when they're exploding they're CG at times. But like, even when they're exploding, like, you know, the shots they have of, we talked about this one of our last episodes, Mauhawk and even Sebulba's pod when it's breaking apart. And Sebulba, you know, at the very end when he's just in his pod and he slams his fists on the ground, that's a miniature. Like, there's just a lot of absurd things that are kind of lost. Attack of the Clones onward, even though Attack of the Clones has some insane miniatures as well, like the entire Geonosian gladiatorial pit is a miniature, right? Things like that. But mainly what Phantom Menace did was the composite work, where it was taking bigatures, which Peter Jackson coined too, moving forward, which was... Peter Jackson coined the bigatures moving forward too, which was making giant miniatures of cities and sets and things like that, and then compositing them in the shots with actors. Almost everything in Lord of the Rings is done that way, and that's why it looks so good and why it holds up. And the same with especially Phantom Menace, but all the prequels are like that. And of course, as time goes on, we get further and further away from that because of CGI advancing so far, which is a big deal. And let's not forget, you know, Mike, we've said time and time again, love it or hate it, Jar Jar was the first fully CGI created character, even pre Gollum, which is weird to think about because everybody kind of thinks of Andy playing Gollum as the quintessential CGI, fully CGI character. But Ahmed was on set wearing the full costume so they could get all the lighting and things like that. And then he was made CGI wise.
And we've talked about, you know, the things that Ahmed Best has dealt with in previous episodes.
Well, yeah, Mike, and that's right. And like, of course, you didn't get to go to the panel, but like, as I said on the show, like, he got a standing ovation at the Star Wars Episode 1 panel just like Kelly Marie Tran, like he just got this huge standing ovation, and man, he's so cool. And the hate really bothers me, but you know, that's kind of the world we live in, I guess. Character for the kids, well, and, you know.
And I mean, yes, the harassment of an actor is wrong. There's not liking, quote, or quote, hating a character and then, you know, harassing the person who played
the
him.
Performer,
and
that, yeah.
That's not actor. Right. Because as an adult, no, I don't like Jar Jar Binks. Despite all that George says about he was supposed to be the Star Wars version of Goofy.
Yeah.
I mean, and all that really other is. Stuff. Like, I don't think it's a good character, but I would never hold that against, you know, an actor, right?
Right. Well,
same way, like if I didn't like The Last Jedi, I would never attack Rian Johnson. Or if I cared about Game of Thrones and I didn't like the last season, I would never attack the creators of it.
That's kind of crazy. Yeah, that's just the way the world is these days, I suppose. But you know, I don't know about you, Mike, but maybe because of our age, I think also the internet being in its infancy, I don't remember the extreme hate for Jar Jar till years and years later, 5 years plus later, at least. I know that there was obviously backlash, so much so that George minimized Jar Jar's role in episode 2 and removed him from episode 3 because George was so brokenhearted about it. But I don't know. I feel like it's gotten worse with every passing year in some ways until recently.
Like, it got worse as the internet grew. Right. And then
it sucks.
That generation that grew up with it started living online.
Right.
And sort of forgave or redeemed or whatever, started bringing some positivity to it.
Okay. Yeah. That's part of it, too.
Yeah.
I really like the Gungans, for the record, by the way. I know Jar Jar is kind of he's the joker, the jester. The fool of the Gungan race, but I love the Gungans personally. Like, they're one of my favorite races. They're pretty interesting. Like,
the Gungans are design, cool. Yeah. Jar Jar is just too much.
Right. too much. Well, that's all right, because he plays his role in this film for the kids, and he actually plays a major role in the plot, as we know. It's not like he doesn't even have a role.
It's all his fault.
No, it's not all his fault. he literally brings everybody together at the end, which is crazy.
That's right. It's all his fault in episode 3, my bad.
It's all his fault in episode 2, actually. Yeah.
Was it 2? Yeah. Oh, you're right. It's right at the end.
Grand Army of the Republic. Yeah, that's Jar Jar. Because Palpatine manipulates him, which is perfectly within Palpatine's character and perfectly within Jar Jar's character, being manipulated by someone like that. Which is really sad, and I don't know, Mike, if you remember the Jar Jar chapter and aftermath, but it is amazing.
I absolutely
do. It is so good. Chuck Wendig knows characters. Maybe more than the original people who write the characters. The remorse I felt for Jar Jar in that chapter was unreal, and the feels. Because basically Jar Jar, spoilers, if you haven't read Aftermath and you don't want to know what one mini chapter is, but Jar Jar has become a poor street performer on Naboo, and that's kind of what his life is.
Was it Naboo or Coruscant?
It's one of the two. That's a good question, Mike. I asked that. And that's what his life has amounted to, because kind of like you said, Mike, because he was responsible for some things, and also just the way he is. He's kind of an outcast, a joker, a fool, and classic mythology and all that. And yeah, it just and he's met by another orphan child on the streets, and they kind of form a relationship, and it's rough, man. It's like, man, that's even Jar Jar in the canon is having a hard time, you know, because he's not really, he's kind of an outcast everywhere, especially after the events of the prequels, because the Grand Army of the Republic turns out being kind of bad. So,
yeah.
But past Jar Jar.
So we went down some big rabbit holes there. And I do want to say some things that I like about the prequels.
Yeah.
And we've been recording long enough on two different takes. Have we talked about video games in this second take?
Probably not. We should do that because we were on a roll until that power outage in my house from a tornado, probably knocking out a transformer over here.
That's right, because for all the crap I give the movie, some of the best. The storytelling elements and world building are great. And for me, that played out memorably in the video games that we got, particularly games like Starfighter, the pod racing Racer. Game, and Jedi Power Battles, which is a often forgotten about PlayStation 1 title, but it was so different, not necessarily gameplay-wise, but like in terms of a Star Wars game.
Yeah.
That it definitely made an impression.
Yeah, Mike and I played a lot of all those games. We also played... Jedi Power Battles, Mike, like I was saying, I loved it so much because it was mainly our major exposure to the other Jedi Masters on the Council, other than the short scenes we saw in the film with them talking to Qui-Gon and Anakin. I played Master Plo all the time. I loved Master Plo. As you know, I have an affinity for the alien races, and people like Adi Gallia and Mace Windu and, you know, all these characters were in it, which is very exciting. And on top of that, we had the episode one game, I guess, was what it was called, where it was the entire movie of episode one, but only from Obi-Wan's perspective, except a couple levels where you're Qui-Gon on Tatooine. And that was pretty exciting as well, if you remember that. It was kind of free roam, which was unheard of at the time for a Star Wars linear game. So much so.
Made it harder.
Yeah, made it way harder. For instance, the Qui-Gon levels, you're on Mos Espa and you kind of got to free roam and do what you wanted to do, and there was a lot to do and see. Same thing with the Obi-Wan levels. On top of that, episode one spouted some other games years later, like with the release of the Xbox, the Obi-Wan title, and that was kind of a launch title for the Xbox alongside Halo 1 and some other notable titles. And that was also a big deal at the time because, you know, just a different type of video game where you're only playing as Obi-Wan. And a strange thing they tried in this game, which I think was partially successful, Mike, and partially completely unsuccessful. I don't know if you remember this about the Obi-Wan video game, but you used basically just the two joysticks. That was about it. A couple other buttons, but the one joystick was your lightsaber. One joystick was the movement. And you never used a joystick for a lightsaber in a third person game before. And that was kind of different.
Do you remember the Star Wars racer that you used the most in Pod Racer? I was looking down the list of names.
I used Gasgano a lot.
Gasgano, yeah.
Yeah, he was pretty solid across the board, if I remember right. His stats were kind of
everything
baseline. Anakin was really fun because he was so fast, but his health and his durability and stuff was way low. But of course, I like to play Sebulba the most, I think, because he was so tanky.
I was a fan of Team Toe Pagalis.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, Mike, we need to get on the game that is modding your Switch, because I saw someone recently had modded their Switch to play Star Wars Racer, and I don't know.
What?
There's guides online how to do this. I'm not sure how it's done. It's probably the SIM card ROM or something, but looked pretty cool.
It's going to brick my Switch.
It might. But I think if you follow the guides, it works. Star Wars Racer and Star Wars Racer's Revenge also might came out for this, which was kind of a continuation of the story. But of course, Racer was the most notable to everyone because the Bounty Eve Classic was on it. The race from the film with all the Q-tip crowd people and the giant miniature.
But and this thing came out at peak Nintendo 64 fever too.
Right. You might even need that little expansion graphics card thing.
Did you? I can't remember if you had to have that or not.
You did for Turok 2, which I was very invested in at the time. But, yeah.
And Majora's Mask, yeah.
Majora's Mask as well.
So we would be bad Star Wars fans if we also did not talk about the score for Phantom Menace.
One of the best.
Because holy butts, it's great.
That's right. I know this has been said 1,000 times, but we continue to say it, and, you know, you guys get to listen to us say it again. But, of course, Phantom Menace score all around is just great. John Williams was in true form, Mike. He'd taken a break from Star Wars and he'd come back in full force. Some of my personal favorite songs. The Duel of Fates, of course, might be one of the best Star Wars songs ever written, and that's not really extreme to say. But songs I like Darth Maul's theme, which is...
Ever written might be a bit of a stretch.
Of Star Wars songs? Okay. No, I don't think so.
That's not what you said. You said songs.
Oh, I said Star Wars songs. It's probably a thunderstorm cut me out. Star Wars songs ever written, without a doubt, top five, top 10, you know, Duel of Fates. But a favorite songs of mine in the film, Jar Jar's got a pretty interesting song. We also have Darth Maul's music. Darth Maul's music, which is kind of the, just the, I'm sure you know it, Mike, the vocal perform. It's mainly vocals, kind of the monk type vocals, the Darth Maul music. Like when he's bringing out the probes, when Darth Maul's in the red hallway with Qui-Gon, that music I'm very into.
So yeah, I was trying to find this video to.
I don't know, not that again.
Where people try to put lyrics to do the recorder. Corn on the cob.
I thought you were gonna put that recorder thing again. That was too much.
Oh well, I am now because you reminded me about it.
Yeah, the Darth Maul music where he's pacing in the hallway, also where he's doing the probe droids. Palpatine's themes are introduced in this, which is pretty cool. It's a redux of the Palpatine theme from Return of the Jedi, of course. But it's the Sidious theme, which is different, which is very exciting. There's some good themes. The Trade Federation theme, Mike, which is very similar kind of to the First Order theme of the new films. And the Kylo Ren theme, which is kind of that marching type theme. Some really notable ones in this. Padme's got her own theme. There's a lot. It's
big. The most impressive thing about this was John Williams was already 100 years old when he wrote this score, and he's finishing up the sequel trilogy this year.
That's right. The Yoda puppet, which has been since removed from the films, looked younger than him at the time. So,
very true.
Rip the Yoda puppet that was Uncanny Valley, but.
Oh man. Well, we have talked more about Phantom Menace than I thought we would. And I
could keep talking.
I want to get this point out there again to people.
Uh-oh.
I like the Phantom Menace. I'm just reiterating a point I made on a previous episode when we had the guys from the podcast The War Starts at Midnight on. It's okay to love bad movies. And to me, that's where the Phantom Menace falls. I love a lot of things about it.
Yeah, and you love bad movies.
As a movie.
Like you like bad movies. So do okay. I too.
You say that like you don't. Everybody loves different bad movies.
100%.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I'm just saying that, let's not pretend like this thing is, you know, an all-time great. It accomplished a lot of... good things in the film industry, technologically. There's so much world building there, a lot of things to love, but the movie itself ain't great, and that's okay.
I like a chunk of modern day Ridley Scott. So there you go.
Fair. Very fair.
To be fair, he is a master filmmaker. He's just not in his prime anymore. That's a whole nother thing, a whole nother topic. Well, but
you could say the same thing about George Lucas.
You could. Yeah. But I think, Mike, the thing with Phantom Menace, and I've told you this a lot off the air different times, and I've actually told a lot of people this, and this is an interesting discussion itself, and I don't really know what becomes of this, but I think it's worth mentioning. The Phantom Menace is an okay movie. It might be a bad Star Wars movie following the original trilogy, and here's the difference. Why I say that: if the Phantom Menace was a different property, say Transformers, for example, maybe it would be praised.
Or Valerian or something.
Valerian was way worse than the Phantom Menace. I don't know if you've seen it. It was horrendous.
No, not Jupiter Ascending. That's the one
Yeah, that was horrendous too. I said that. You're proving my point. The Phantom Menace is a not great Star Wars movie, but it's a pretty decent movie. It's actually a pretty good movie in a lot of ways. But it's complicated because when you have the Star Wars lineage and lore and ties to American culture and the world tied to it, it gets tough. right? We judge it on a different standard. This is kind of what we were talking about. Like, it's more acceptable even for like an X-Men movie or a Marvel movie or a Transformers movies, these other huge properties, right? Just not the size of Star Wars, to be as bad or worse than the Phantom Menace, which, guess what? They are all the time. And that's more acceptable than the Phantom Menace being the level it's at because it is Star Wars. And that's...
X-Men, I agree with you. What Marvel movies are worse than the Phantom Menace?
The whole bottom half we mentioned, like the whole bottom 5 or 10 we mentioned on our podcast, probably.
What podcast did we mention that on? Oh,
man, what a plug for the Patreon. The Secret Stash, Mike. We ranked all of our Marvel films, you and I individually, the 21 films that were out at the time. And I think that lower half is comparable or lower than the Phantom Menace easily. And, you know, you and I basically had a similar lower half, so we can just throw out some of them right now. Hulk, Thor 1 and 2. What else do we have? We had quite a bit.
I don't know. I feel like you had Iron Man 3 undeservedly at the bottom. It was at the
upper part of the bottom of those, yeah. I just think, like, the Phantom Menace is as good or, you know, that equal to or less than some of those. Vice versa, but the fact that it's Star Wars puts it on a whole nother plane. I enjoy The Phantom Menace more than all those movies. I'll just say that right now. I don't know. Iron Man 3, you're getting complicated now, Mike, but yeah, I think I enjoy it more than Iron Man 3 for sure. So it's just kind of complicated because it's Star Wars, so we rate it from a different perspective because we've talked about all this on the show so far. The lore of Star Wars, George Lucas, what he's created up to this point, right? There's standards. And when it changes, you know, like when Ridley Scott creates Alien, but then later he creates Prometheus. Prometheus is not terrible, but it's terrible because Ridley Scott created Alien. Does that make sense?
Prometheus is not a good movie.
Prometheus is not utterly terrible, though. It's only utterly terrible because Ridley Scott has created Alien and all these other films that like are considered like the films, right?
Well, I think we're just getting into splitting hairs on words because I'm not saying it's terrible, but it is.
But
not
you get
a
what I'm saying,
movie.
Right? Like, yeah. And Prometheus is another great example of the Phantom Menace effect, where it's like there's huge flaws, but then there's huge leaps in the technology and other things and the sets and things like that, right? But like, maybe a director's lost his way, but like we're rating from that standard. We're not rating from, well, was this Incredible Hulk movie good? No, it was bad. You know, was this X-Men movie good? No, it was bad. Not thinking the whole mythos of X-Men and, you know, the directors of X-Men, which have been numerous. We're not thinking that. We're not thinking George Lucas Star Wars.
Not numerous enough, but that's
right. But you
story.
Know what I mean? We're not thinking George Lucas and Star Wars. We're thinking properties. And I don't know what Star Wars is different. Maybe its size, its impact. That's probably the biggest part.
Yeah, you know, modern day, man, Marvel movies have a bigger impact than Star Wars does.
Bigger or the same? That's probably the better way to
bigger.
Say it.
Well, no, bigger.
I think you're right when you say widespread is the word, right? Like width.
The impact of Marvel movies today is bigger than the impact of Star Wars movies today.
Yeah, they're more palpable.
And this
they're
is maybe palpable. A future episode for us to talk about.
No, I think they're easier to swallow. I think most people would rather go see Thor 1 than The Phantom Menace if they've never seen either film, because Thor 1 is easier to digest, even though it's a worse movie, in my opinion, than The Phantom Menace.
It's been so long since I've seen Thor 1. I don't know how to weigh in.
But you know
on
what I mean?
One.
Like, it's just, it's self-contained, simple story. And as you mentioned before, the strengths and weaknesses of the prequels is the immense world building and also trying to world build on top of a previous trilogy in a way. The mythic lore of a pre-existing trilogy. So it's an interesting thing. It's an interesting discussion always to return to, but I think someone who enjoys the prequels, I always think it's worth mentioning because it kind of gives the prequels like a weird slant when people judge them, because it's like parts that are okay, the prequels are considered bad because it's Star Wars. And parts that are bad of the prequels are considered horrendous because it's Star Wars. Does that make sense?
And to a large extent, I agree with you, but I still don't think any of the three prequels are good movies.
You don't think Revenge of the Sith is a good movie? What does good mean to you? Like, just above decent?
Like a... I will watch the prequels because they are Star Wars.
Right, and that goes a long way for you.
And it goes a long way. Revenge of the Sith is closest to being a good movie, but I don't think it's a good movie.
So it's like right under good for you. It's like, yeah. It's like pushing the edge. If it had some tweaks, maybe.
If George had had some help writing, it might be there.
Because the story's there.
Episodes 1 and 2, they need more help than just writing. But it's the closest to what I would call a good movie. But like I'm not meaning that as a slam on it. I love plenty of terrible movies.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's not a terrible movie. It's just not a good movie either. Like I would consider all three of the prequel trilogy and the sequel trilogy movies.
Right.
I don't think Rogue One is a good movie either, but I still like it.
Right. It's definitely a good movie.
So it's not like I'm saying it's like trash.
Well, and this gets into what you said earlier, basically, the episode one is like an elevated camp movie, which is true to an extent. But like the fact that it's Star Wars makes the camp weirder. Does that make sense? Because some of my favorite movies are camp movies.
I am not taking credit for camp. I took that from a Birth Movies Death article that I posted on our Twitter.
Birth Movies Death is just great.
Making sure that no one.
Yeah. but to give you an example, like Mike, as you know, but to say to our listeners, like Evil Dead 2. Evil Dead 1 and Army of Darkness are some of my favorite films, and they are camp city. Like they're camp, but are so aware and so within their world building and their budget and everything. Like it's great. So,
and that's what's lacking in the prequels is awareness.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're trying to do too much at once, I think is what a lot of people have said. And maybe that's where the camp comes in, because they're trying to do all this insane world building, all this character development, all these other characters, side characters, major plots. You know, this is really Palpatine's story in a lot of ways. and, you know, we do all this other stuff on the side. But, you know, let's talk about episode one specifically. So what is your favorite moment of episode one, Mike? Or maybe not even moment, like, design, because we talked about how brilliant Doug Chain's design was and the miniatures and all that. I have so many.
I mean, even though I don't necessarily remember seeing the movie in theaters as a kid, it's the lightsabers igniting with Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon
and the dual face queuing.
A close second is just like the pod racing scene. I think pod racing was a great addition to Star Wars that honestly hasn't been taken advantage of enough since then.
See, and I like that you mentioned that, because you're a lot of people that have complaints about the prequels, specifically episode 1 and 2, specifically episode 1, cite the pod race as too much pure spectacle, and a fairly grounded film, like they say about, like, you know, the greater narrative.
And those are the people that take Star Wars way too seriously. It is spectacle.
When George says that too, he says it's, you know, this boy proving his skills, but like really it's spectacle and miniatures flying down canyons with a camera on 4x speed driving down.
Yeah, you like that? a guy with a Star Wars podcast saying that some people take Star Wars too seriously.
Right. What's that?
But it's true.
Yeah, they really do, because the pod race, you're right, Mike. The pod race is really fun. The miniatures and sets are insane, but like the idea of pod racing in Star Wars is so consistent with the universe of Star Wars, like gambling on these races. And, you know, it's like we've been told 1,000 times. It's so dangerous that certain races of the galaxy can't even do it, right? And it's like, it's lucrative, it's dangerous, your engines can explode. You know, it's, you know, Sebulba is great in the race. We've talked about this a lot. And Watto and Warwick, I always love in their little gambling box.
And there's no physiological reason why Sebulba should be good at pod racing and a human.
Why his brain is so fast, his reaction time or something.
Yeah.
Apparently, Dougs have good reaction time, Mike, is what we're getting out of this. I don't know. So, but, you know, it's insane stuff. Like, you know, those sets, like the Pod Racer set where they're staging the pods is real set mixed with miniature set. Insane stuff like that. But, like, okay, so for you, it's that. Obviously, for me, igniting the lightsabers once again is a very high point for me because that is one of the great moments of Star Wars. Like, we, the doors open, we hear Darth Maul's music.
One blade? No, there's two.
We open the doors and we're like, we're going to get the Viceroy. Doors open, Darth Maul's there, his theme plays, and the beginning of Duel Fates plays, and it's like, we're going
and to. I mean, we'll yeah. handle this. It's That's great. A great line.
I also really like a lot of the design. In episode one, if you haven't picked up on that yet, I really like the pod racers, the Naboo stuff. That's kind of the 1920s stuff. I like the Naboo ships a lot. I really like the N1 fighters. I like the Queen ship a lot. I like Naboo. Naboo's cool that they filmed in Italy. That's awesome. Real sets.
Yeah.
Florence and Italy and things like that for real sets.
You lied to me. You said we could knock this episode out in like 20 minutes, and we've been talking about Phantom Menace for like 45. Well, we hope you enjoyed this retrospective-ish on Phantom yeah. Menace. Like, it was a celebration of it, even though I did not necessarily celebrate everything about it like the internet seemed to the past few days. I still like oh, yeah. the movie. It gave so much to Star Wars.
So much.
Still watch it at least a couple times a year. So don't come after me.
I like Star you Wars mentioned Twitter. That. That's good. Yeah. I did too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dad really likes the movie. I mentioned my dad's favorite moment as we're here since he's the fan that got me into Star Wars. My dad likes the moment where they close the blast doors and Qui-Gon just sticks his entire lightsaber through the blast doors and just starts melting the door. My dad was like, I've never seen a lightsaber do that. Makes perfect sense. That is awesome. And that was a nice touch.
You know, I'm gonna tie the prequel era back to my favorite part of Star Wars. And it's in Star Tours, The Adventures Continue, okay. when the Starspeeder 1000 crashes into the hangar on Naboo and the tail of the N1 Starfighter breaks Whoa. The glass of the windshield and the 3D makes it look like the point is, you know, in the cabin with you.
You just got me so excited to do Star Tours, Mike, because I have not been since the changes because I'm not a Disney-a-file like Mike. Like
what?
Mike.
What? You haven't ridden Star? Oh my God, that's okay.
I haven't been to Star Tours being since the right prequel and sequel trilogy inclusion or whatever.
You haven't been since they took out my favorite Captain Rex. Oh boy, this is a thing that we're gonna have to deal yeah, no, with later. Video, right? Anyway. In the meantime, you can check out the Canon Cantina like all over the places you find podcasts. We have a website, thecanoncantina.com, at the Canon Cantina on all your social medias, all that.
That's
stuff.
Right. And as we mentioned earlier, the Canon Cantina is supported by our wonderful patrons on Patreon. If you'd like to help the show, go to patreon.com. That's patreon.com/thecanoncantina and pledge your support. It's a place where we talk about things that aren't necessarily Star Wars, even though Mike, I gotta say this episode, no outline, no nothing. We just typed Phantom Menace. That was it. We just went with this. It's a little bit more like the Patreon, even the Patreon's definitely looser.
That's true.
It's definitely looser and it's definitely different topics.
More PG-13 rated.
But it's kind of like this, kind of free form. We like it. And once you pledge your support on Patreon and give us a couple bucks a month, if you deem the show worthy of that, it's an opt-in subscription and you will get access to our Patreon feed and get to participate in other things like that, Mike. And all that money goes to help support us. You directly support the show and you help us pay all of our fees, but that's the direct way to support the show. And we've got more Secret Stash episodes coming up, but I just had to mention that while we are here.
We promise.
We promise. So help spread the word of our show by subscribing, rating, or reviewing. If you think we do something better or you have an idea for another episode, email us at canoncantina@gmail.com.
That's right. So This episode is going to come out at a random point in the middle of the week. Surprise. You can find our regular release talking about Darksaber, the second Monday. Book in the Callista Legends trilogy. That'll be coming out next Monday. Enjoy that one.
Yeah.
Because I don't know that we enjoyed talking
about
it.
We certainly did more than children.
We are slogging our way through. Oh, man. When I edited that Children of the Jedi episode, I was like, I don't remember saying any of these words or anything about this story because it's so forgettable. And
Mike, that was years ago. That was pre-Celebration. That was years ago. We record Children of the Jedi right before we left for Celebration. So if we sound different.
I feel like we recorded it like a month before we left for Celebration. If we sound different,
there's the transparency there for you guys. But yeah, Darksaber on Monday. And then after that, the following Monday, we will finish up the series with Planet of Twilight. So you're following along at home with this Callista trilogy. Give those books a read and hear our thoughts on Luke's journey. After this, we're going to return to canon material. So stay.
Maybe someday we'll get back to talking about good stuff.
We will. We're getting there one day. Yeah. So
someday. So that'll do it for this special installment of the Canon Cantina. Cheers, where everybody.
Are those droidicas.
My God.
Boring conversation anyway.